Okay, the stalwart group that's still here. To conclude our conference, we've asked Dan Weary to provide some closing remarks. Dan is professor of the NSERC Industrial Research Chair in Animal Welfare at the University of British Columbia, and he's followed the progress of farm animal welfare and its advancements, its issues, and its diverse viewpoints for several years. He will be addressing framing NFAC in a Canadian and international context. Thanks, Dan.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much, Susan and Jackie and the board of NFAC. What a great pleasure and honor to be working with such a group. I'm a proud member of the inaugural team. I was originally on the NFAC board when it first started, and I'm a refugee from the old expert committee process. I'll talk about that in a minute. I've only got one PowerPoint slide, I'll come back to this later. But just to begin with, this is just our coffee room at our dairy farm, the UBC Dairy Farm, and that picture on the left is just part of the team. And I just wanted to show off that our mountains in British Columbia look even better than the Albertan mountains, even though we don't have quite as many horses. It's a really good place for rearing dairy cattle. And on that photo, you see a bunch of members of our team, including the researchers and the farm staff, and most notably Nelson Din, who's the manager of our amazing farm. Okay, a bit of history. I think it's important to come back for those of you that haven't. I'm starting to feel old. Isn't that horrible? I look at myself in the mirror and I think of myself as still being young, but actually, I hate to admit I turned 50 this year, and I know. Cry me river, but anyways, and for some of you people I've been working with for a long time, but others, of course, are new to the game and don't realize some of the history. So I thought I'd just start off by talking a little bit about where we come from as a way of acknowledging how far we have actually come. And so if you think back to the pre-2005 days, the pre-NFAC days, we had this expert committee in farm animal welfare and behavior. And that was a moribund group. And it was actually euthanized when the federal government pulled the funding for it. And if only we'd had the Zephyr gun then, right? It should have happened. It's good that it did happen. But it was an amazing period of disquiet as well, because although everybody realized that the expert committee was not living up to its potential, nobody knew what would grow in its ashes. And we are really amazing, actually, that NFAC emerged like a phoenix. It was it's remarkable. I also should say, by way of history, sorry to talk so much about myself, but I got my start in animal welfare when David Fraser invited me to come join his group at the Central Experimental Farm here in Ottawa. And I started off, among other things, castrating piglets. So it was good to see some pig castration talking today, and I should come back to that issue a little bit later. But then went on, of course, to the University of British Columbia, where we've got this great group, and very pleased and proud to be there and working mostly with the dairy industry. And the dairy industry have been amazingly generous in terms of taking me under their wing, and I think in terms of supporting animal welfare research in general on the dairy side. I also want to talk in terms of a bit of the history is to acknowledge the amazing process that we have come up with. I think there's been some good discussion today about where we need to go, and I'm going to come back to some of those points. But I want to sort of celebrate what happened in terms of the code development process, this idea of creating this separation of a scientific committee that develops a series of recommendations formed by the scientists with some back and forth, good open discussion with the code committee in terms of developing a list of key issues. But the scientist committee can go and do its work without any of the horse trading. This is just the science and where it is. And then the development of the report that then goes to the code committee. But then at the code committee, where the chair, and I was lucky to be part of that process as well, on the development of the dairy code, is able to then participate in the broader committee. But then the scientists are just one vote. They've got the scientists' report, the review, but of course not all the decisions are made about science, but at least the science is clear. And I think it went a long way in terms of making the issue really clear and transparent, and making the cases where we wanted to and can use the science base, fine, and other cases where the science is not there or where other issues trump out, that's fine too, but it's all up in the open. And I think that's an amazing development. Years, I think this writer said yesterday, in terms of the age of some of the codes. It's amazing, again, to be here now. Edouard just talking about this huge effort, unprecedented effort of developing all these codes over a very short period of time. And those codes needed to be redone. So it's been focused in over a shorter period, too short a period. We had to get it done, but it's been too short. I'll come back to that in a minute too. But the fact of the matter is, today I think we have a lot to celebrate about and a lot to be happy with in terms of this process that's been developed and this wonderful new set of codes to show off to the rest of the world. That code development process, I think, is one of the sort of solid foundations. Another thing that Gord mentioned in his comments yesterday, but I think it's come up a bunch of times, is also this Gord referred to as the Canadian advantage, that somehow or other in the code process we've been able to do this, getting people together in a room and hashing things out and working through to a consensus. Even though it's hard and even though we often disagree, we've managed to get it done. I think that is an amazing extra element of the success story. The other bit, which I think is which is so important, it's not quite there yet, but it's so important, I think the conversation has also come along so far, is the animal care assessment model, animal care assessment framework, as we now call it, the work on that issue. And I think that even a few years ago, we weren't even within this room, people weren't really necessarily seeing eye to eye on that. And I feel, coming back to the committee this year, that wow, I can't believe how that conversation has changed. And also, of course, the knowledge base that we have. We've had a lot more experiences, we tried things out, and I think there's a much clearer sense of where we can go and should go with animal care assessment. We just had this this sobering discussion on the future of this organization. I mean, here we are, I am coming in and thinking, wow, what wonderful accomplishments have taken place in the years that I haven't been involved in NFAC, the distance that it's come, and to think that it all really is just resting really on this sort of shoestring type of contract researcher type scenario is disquieting. It's very good to hear around the room the level of support for NFAC, and I think Ryder's comments are the ones that I'm going to really take home in terms of our responsibility to make sure that message gets back outside of this room. And I think that that's maybe a challenge for all of us as we go back to our respective provinces and institutions. Another comment that came up, which I thought was important, was to say that, and I think this is the way I feel. I'm always an incurable optimist in these things, but I do believe that the work is just so important. The track record of NFAC is just so impressive. There isn't a question of if NFAC should continue. It simply must continue. But I do think that we all need to be saying that a little more and a little louder. Okay. Where do we need to go? Assuming it must go on, it will go on, what then are going to be our challenges for the future? Well, hopefully we won't have 8 new codes to attack, at least not immediately. Although there will, of course, be this process of continual updating and reviving of the codes, as the science changes and as culture changes within industry and within the broader society in which we live. And that's good. I'm sure that will happen and it must happen. In addition, though, I think there's some other things that we need to think about, some of that have come up today and some of which haven't. But I think even though we should be very proud in terms of what the process at NFACT has created around the codes, we should also be reconsidering that process. And there's a couple different things that I think that should be talked about. One is and again, sort of to come back to this sort of the idea of this Canadian advantage, this consensus base, we get around a small table, we duke it out, we work it out, we come out of the end of that room. But there's problems in that model, even as we heard today, that maybe that room's just a little bit small. Maybe we need actually to be broadening the input at a number of different levels, both in terms of getting more people in the room, but also really right from the outset be doing a much better job in terms of consulting with the broader community, and that means both the broader community within the agricultural sector as well as the citizens that we share our communities with. The other bit, which I can talk to as a scientist, is, and of which I'm guilty because I helped co-chair the scientist review on the dairy code, is that we have this process. The way it was supposed to work is that we do all this wonderful science, this group of scientists get together, the scientists do this wonderful work, and they write this up in the form of a publishable manuscript that then goes off for the proper peer review process. And that's important. I mean, it's not just a game that scientists play that sending things off for peer review. It's the third-party quality assurance, right? And that's what gives it that special sauce of recognition and value. And I understand why we've had to, because we've had to get these things out. But that process, I think, hasn't been pushed to the level it should. I would like to see in the future a world where we're striking the scientist committee 2 years before the code committee. And the scientist goes and they do their work and they actually send that out for proper peer review, and it is published in a scientific journal beforehand. Then that's done, then the code committee can come along and they've got a recent version of the facts, but they can get on with their work. And that keeps that process, I think that will raise the scientific work to the next level, and that's where it needs to be. And there's a transparency issue there, which I think is also really important. There's been a lot of talk today about the public accountability aspect, and I think that's hugely appreciated. I learned a lot today, and I very much appreciated that discussion. And I think we need to be listening to that very carefully. It's wonderful. Again, we should celebrate the amazing work that we did in the current codes in terms of having that broad input both around the table but then also the public consultation. But we need to realize that although that might have looked pretty good in 2005, maybe that's not cutting edge anymore in 2013. And some things that I heard today that I was that made an impression with me is the idea that the public consultation maybe that we're doing now is a relatively weak form of that, where once we've already got a pretty established draft of the code and then we go out and we ask people what they think, it's sort of like what Stephanie said, where we are consulting with the public once we've already made a decision. And it's not quite that, I know that, but that's maybe the impression that we give. And I also heard the comment about going into the consultation with the idea that we're going to persuade or convince. A favorite term is that, you know, our activities are all about educating the public, or indeed, if we're on the other side, maybe about educating the producer. And this idea that if they don't share our values, we're going to educate them into it. And that's, of course, it's going to be a failed model. It's only going to result in further alienation. And it was lovely to hear that so clearly today, and hopefully we can take that to heart when we think about the next generation of public consultation. We need to instead be creating this culture of openness and inclusiveness and providing a real voice to those people who feel that the decisions we make are affecting their lives. And that's, I know that's not going to be easy, but that's what we have to be doing. Okay, I want to come back to the animal care assessment aspect because I think it's just so important. Again, we heard that a bit yesterday and reinforced a bunch of times today. Jeff just said, what was the quote? It's not enough to say we're doing it. We have to show we're doing it. And I think we are all on board with that now. And I want to applaud the dairy industry in particular for taking the leadership in terms of that ACAF process. It's important to recognize we get used to living in the bizarre dysfunctional system that we have, right? But this patchwork of provincial jurisdiction on these issues, when you talk to people in the rest of the world, they're just bewildered by it, right? And so you try to explain, well, what are we doing in terms of animal care issues? And you say, well, you know, the Newfoundland, they do this. And their eyes have long since glazed over by the time you come to New Brunswick, right? And wow, I mean, we've got a system now that's decided at a national level, and we've got the commodity group itself out there assessing it, out there on every farm, providing assessments countrywide, one system. Wow, that's Canadian. Pretty good, eh? So as a researcher too, of course, I have my hidden agenda. One of the really cool things about all that is it also provides this wonderful data set and this cool opportunity to do the benchmarking stuff. So I'm going to come talk a little bit more about benchmarking in a minute. Okay, where do we need to go next? And so sorry, my apologies to the organizer at this point. I mean, it's sort of fun to get the open mic for the last session of the day. So there's a few things which is sort of Dan's random thoughts, and feel free to throw tomatoes or whatever if you're sufficiently bored or disagreeable. I'll try to be just disagreeable enough to keep you awake, but not to get the tomatoes. I loved about 99% of what I heard today. And I think that obviously you're in a room with people with a lot of shared histories and shared values. But there's a few things that I hear which make me want to change the tenor of the conversation. I think sometimes we get stuck in ruts that we mustn't get stuck in. And one of those ruts is that often we're framing animal welfare issues as, well, it's this system or that system. Right, the yes or the no that Jeff talked about earlier. And I don't think, well, let me change that. There's a lot that can be done to improve animal welfare that is actually all within the same system, that's all in that sort of that win-win zone where doing something better for the animal is actually going to make it easier for the producer. Those lovely videos that Ed showed of giving the 5-cent lidocaine injection, all of a sudden you have one guy doing the disbudding, much nicer procedure for the person too, instead of having three. These are the sort of the no-brainer type things that we need to still do the research to show it works and to get this sort of peer-to-peer mentoring, learning from others in terms of within an existing system to show the better and the worse, the more successful, the less successful. So in other words, focusing on the low-hanging fruit. And I mean, we had, that can include some very practical, sensible stuff like the disbudding example we saw earlier or the euthanasia guns, wonderful stuff. And I think there's a lot, though, coming back to the benchmarking of where we can learn from this wonderful data that we can get when we go and visit different farms. And we've done a lot of this work recently working on dairy farms. And part of the fun is that we've done a lot of experimental work, and it's nice to, you do this research in your own little world, even though I think we've got a wonderful farm, it's our farm, and it's a little bit different. And then you go out and how does it apply into somebody else's farm, and sometimes it doesn't. And so if you go and you do work on the individual farms, you begin to understand what are the challenges they have and also what are the exceptional things that they might be doing, not only the challenges, but the tricks that they have that you'd never seen. One of the things we've been looking at recently is in lameness and, for example, hock lesions, very common. One of the interesting things is when you go and you visit hundreds of farms, you go onto farms where there are zero hock lesions, zero. And you go into the farms, And every cow has a Hock lesion. And we're not talking about, well, it's one wacko farm out in, you know, wherever, and another guy in a completely different situation. These are in the same province, the same breed, the same housing system, the same economic constraints, right? So it shows the wonderful opportunity that we have right there, sort of at the tip of our noses, to make big differences that matter to animals. And these are also big differences that make the lives of the farmers working with those animals better too. So I see it, not only is it sort of fun and exciting from the scientist's perspective, it's amazing now working with the producers that are involved with that, because, hey, here they have some scientists giving them back data that they can use to make better decisions about how they want to manage their farms. They get to see where they are relative to, confidentially, where their neighbors are. And then they get to see, you know, are they happy with that? And if they're not happy with that, well, then that sets up a conversation where they can try out different things. Okay. The research is also a bit of a hole, though. One of the things, so I don't like to say much of a positive nature about the old expert committee, but one of the positive things it did was make an attempt to try to coordinate and planning around research potential within the country. And it's been a bit of a sobering year in terms of animal welfare research and research potential in Canada, because Agriculture Canada has basically gotten out of the game. And we've lost some of the most prominent researchers in this area within Canada. And it leads to the question of who's in charge on these things. And I think, I joked about getting my start here in Ottawa with castrating pigs, but that's true. Some of the very first projects that I worked on with David were actually on pig castration. And it's nice now that the Europeans have this fantastic website on it, and there's all this research and interest in the issue. But 20 years ago, let me tell you, there wasn't a lot of interest in the issue. And it was one of these things where I remember going and speaking with a member, a representative from the swine industry, where we had lots of great support too, but talking about the castration stuff, and they said, well, so when are you going to start doing some practical work too? And that's totally normal, of course. I mean, industry's going to have some relatively short-term goals that need to be accomplished now. And that's part of the challenge in terms of trying to develop a portfolio of where we go as a country in terms of the kind of research we're doing is, yeah, but thought of that lovely Wayne Gretzky quote we heard yesterday from Tim about skating not to where the puck's been, but where the puck's going to be, right? And so, okay, you know, the problem with trying to do that, of course, as a researcher, is that about 90% of the time you're going to be wrong. And so, even if you get it right, it takes an awful long time before anybody acknowledges it, right? And so, how do you convince, well, I mean, any hard-nosed funder, but industry is often pretty hard-nosed, to say, oh, no, we should be investing our dollars here, where nine chance out of 10 I'll be wrong, but, you know, if it pays off, it might pay off big. So anyways, I don't know what the answer to that is now, but that's a concern in terms of that research coordination, and I'd love to see, in fact, beginning to at least take some leadership in terms of engaging in a discussion of that, maybe pushing the provinces, pushing the feds, pushing each other for that portfolio of research. I mean, what great examples we hear today Ed talking about the gene editing for dehorning. There's lots, all sorts of really cool sciencey type stuff, and who knows where the applications are going to be. Okay. We need to be focusing on animal welfare as an opportunity and avoid framing the issue as a threat. We heard a bunch of good presentations this morning that reminded us that as soon as we have fearful participants in a debate, the brain shuts down, essentially, right? This is not a great way for making progress on the important issues we're facing if we immediately phrase the issue in terms of the threats associated with animal welfare. And of course, it's not, producers are afraid. We're all afraid of having somebody else take things out of our control, do things that coerces us, that makes decisions for us. But phrasing things in that way sucks the energy out of the room. If instead I think we begin asking, look, how can I improve my practices in a way that's going to improve my bottom line, improve my quality of life, improve the way I interact and the joy I get interacting with my animals, I think we're on a much more positive ground. I'm just going to give you one example of where I've placed where I really feel that positive energy is, bizarrely enough, the South Americans are like totally in. We I think we worry sometimes about, oh my goodness, what's happening in the rest of the world in terms of animal welfare? We've been doing projects actually in both China and in South America, both Chile and Brazil. And in, especially in South America, I went to a meeting a few months ago, a little town in the middle of nowhere. And okay, it's going to be a dairy, all day dairy meeting, dairy only on animal welfare. 500 people come, 500 producers come. It's not like industry reps, humane movement, no. 500 farmers come into the room to spend a day talking about animal welfare. From some English guy, and they have to get it translated into Portuguese, right? So this is, and none of them were there because, oh my goodness, I'm afraid that somebody's gonna come and shut me down if I don't do, no, they're there because I think, oh wow, you mean, I can maybe do this trick and maybe I could make a little bit more money, or maybe I could, they're sucking up the information because they see this as a cool opportunity for making farming better for them. And that, to me, that's the passion of what we do. That's super exciting. So just think of the Brazilians. Another issue which I'd like to maybe end on is this idea of doing a better job in articulating our values. Fred made the point yesterday when he talked about the dynamics around the table of, well, the farmers can sometimes be a bit of a taciturn group, you know, so they're not maybe the best ones. You get them a group around the table, and they're not necessarily going to be the first ones that are going to want to naturally start talking about core values, about, well, what's really most important to me about the way I farm, about what are my beliefs in terms of the type of farm I want to be giving to my children and my grandchildren. Those are hard conversations to be having, but I think and in terms of the messaging that we heard today, and also I guess just more generally a feeling I'm getting as I work in animal welfare more generally, is that we do need to be doing a much better job of talking about shared values within the industry, and those shared values will, I hope, include aspects about animal welfare, but they're also going to include all sorts of other aspects, environmental aspects, and we're going to have to find creative ways of combining that. And again, that was a lovely thing, I think, about what the dairy farmers are doing, is actively trying to include in the animal welfare components and the environmental components, etc. We saw, for example, in Jeff Spooner's talk, efforts to try to engage these conversations, and Eugene Jansen brought the point about the multi-generational discussions that can sometimes happen around the table as a way of bringing out these core values. I think that's great, but I think we need to go to the next level in terms of creating these maybe larger community meetings, town hall type meetings, where we're sharing values within the industry, but we're also talking to our neighbors, other people in our communities, about what farming really means and how we can be sure that we're incorporating those key aspects of our value system and translating those and talking about those in our messaging. So I guess coming back to the farm issue, one thing we do every year is our farm's always open. We have hundreds of visitors, thousands of visitors that come by in a year. We do open houses, and actually some of the best conversations that we have and that our students have are just talking to all the people that come in, agricultural people, rural people, urban people, about our cows and our practices. And I think we learn as much from them as they learn from us. I've got this photo of the coffee room for a reason. not just that picture of the team, but there's that line of trophies. In fact, if you took the focus out a bit, there's trophies all along the wall. There's trophies down a trophy case. And that's great, right? It shows that, A, that we've got a great farm, which we do, and we're acknowledged by our peers, which we are. But it also says, I think, something about about what, at least for us, what farming means, is that the reward structure are not just in the dollars. They're in that recognition about the good things we do. And actually, one of the interesting things, of course, in the dairy side is a lot of the awards are production related. But the people who win the biggest awards aren't necessarily the people that are making the most money. They're hopefully normally profitable, and not necessarily making the most money. And it reinforces that the things that we do in farming aren't always about maximizing profit. They're also about the sense of I want to get the right word for this. It's about being about the pride of practice. And I guess that my final element on that, and really of my point today, would be what can we do in terms of harnessing this idea of pride of practice and maybe move it beyond some of the great awards. Okay, so we've got this one award, which I laugh at, which is highest milk fat in a two-year-old. Now, it's nice to have this wonderful two-year-old that produces this great milk fat. I'm proud of that too, but it may be coming back to a conversation we had earlier about, well, what are our core values? I mean, I think it reflects a value, but it's not a core value. And what I'd like to see actually is that more awards on the shelf, which are, you know, lowest rate of lameness in Kent County. And I think we'd win that. And I think that that's something that, again, in terms of a really practical thing that we can do on the ground within our communities and within our industries is begin to acknowledge these important things that we do, and that I think would also help build that conversation out, that if we have the guy who wins the award for lowest lameness in the county, well, that guy should be out giving the talk to the local farmers, right? So on that note, I'd like to thank again the organizers for the opportunity to do this and for the opportunity to say a few last words. Thanks very much.